So last week we explored this sutta called the Simile of the Saw. And I think it's one of the significant sutta around metta, around this practice of loving kindness. And in this sutta, the Buddha emphasizes how important it is not to have hatred in our hearts. And even though someone may be harming us, insulting us, not to have that closeness of heart. Right? He doesn't talk about losing discernment or losing boundaries or losing that sense of taking care of yourself, but it's more that hardness of heart when you create this sense of separation, when you hate something, someone else, right? That it was really saying that was opposite of what his teaching was. So this is kind of a big ask for us because we often do feel hurt and harmed by people or projection, you know, out to what people have done, and sometimes we've been harmed in tremendous ways. So it's not about saying that it's okay to be harmed. It's not about discounting the impact of that. It's really pointing toward the impact on our own hearts. Like Sharon Salzberg shared this story that she was in Asia someplace on this, like a rickshaw, and this drunk man tried to pull her off and, you know, and insult her. And she, you know, beat them off and got away okay. But her teacher said, oh, Sharon, you should have taken your umbrella and with all the loving kindness in your heart, hit him over the head. You know, so it's like there's that message of if you cannot hold someone outside your heart and yet still have clear, strong boundaries. So that part, you know, the boundary part isn't, I don't really hear that in the sutta. That part, I think we need to kind of flush out any of the teachings if there's something that feels like it's out of balance. But this one piece about no matter what the conditions are, no matter what things have happened, really look at that tendency to harden the heart. You know, and this is perhaps a helpful teaching this election season as we get into the last week of things. And the conditions, you know, the Buddha talks about five different types of ways people can talk to you. They can talk to you in a timely way or an untimely way. They can talk to you in a true way or a false way, affectionate way or a harsh way, beneficial or unbeneficial, from a mind of goodwill or ill will, of hatred. And no matter what whatever they talk to you or whatever words are coming at you, having that sense of, okay, not hardening the heart. He even goes so far as to say, even if you're being, you know, sawed limb from limb by bandits, still not to harden your heart. So he's really making this point. You can imagine some monks were struggling with this, saying, well, it's their fault or it's justified to have this harshness. So hearing that teaching, I can imagine it's easy to say, okay, I've got to act as if I'm really kind. Act as if I'm really loving, even though I'm not really loving. You know, kind of do something, bury those emotions, bury that very human reaction. You know, try to pretend that I'm a kind person, even though I feel really upset or very angry or a lot of hatred in my heart. So the Buddha tells a story about this woman and her servant, and woman presented as being very kind, very loving. But the servant kind of wondered how deep that really went, if it's not more of a presentation. And I think this story was to point toward how it's easy to kind of present yourself in a certain way. When you become a little attached to an image, a self-image of being a kind person, of being a gentle person. I think that's a beautiful thing to aspire to really try to align your actions with. But not at the cost of denying that anger that's there, right? Because if you deny the anger, it comes out in different ways and often also unskillful ways. So we have to learn to attend to that anger, to attend to that hurt. So I think, you know, Dharma practice in itself often needs other support. You know, like for myself, working in a deep way from a therapeutic or a psychological way has been really helpful to balance things out, to be able to work with things which are difficult from, you know, upbringing or conditions, all those things. That just trying to jump over that from a meditative perspective doesn't work. We can even say this is a form of spiritual bypassing. Okay, when we kind of jump over the difficulty. I'm too spiritual for that. I'm more spiritual than that kind of crass human reaction. So the Buddha, I think, perhaps sensed this in some of his followers, his students, and he told this story about this woman and her servant. And the servant decided to test by not doing a good job, basically. That I guess she was very diligent, very good on her job in her work. And then she's just started to get up later and later. And then the mistress got more and more angry about this, you know, after day after day. And finally, she's so angry, she lost her cool and hit her over the head with a rolling pin and cut her head. And then the servant ran out saying, look at the kind woman's handiwork. And there's blood going down her head. So it kind of destroyed the woman's image, which was really kind of a pretend image. So I think this sutta is pointing toward this story that the Buddha chose to tell. It's pointing toward that part of us who wants to kind of pretend that we're nicer than we really are. You know, put on that face, even though inside we're clenched. And this is, in a lot of ways, kind of the safeguard, I think, of this is this quality of metta we've talked about, of turning toward experience, to be with things, as opposed to pushing things away. Sometimes we hear that word loving kindness and think we have to feel this deep sense of emotion, this deep sense of love toward all things. And that's wonderful if that happens. But sometimes that doesn't feel so accessible. You know, sometimes our hearts feel very closed and very locked down. And I think it's more accessible to have this willingness to simply be next to turn toward an experience that is difficult. And that's the power of metta, that if it turns toward something that's in pain, it transforms to compassion. It turns toward and is next to something which is happy, which is successful, which is joyful. It changes to sympathetic joy. You know, so it has this quality of kind of changing based on what it's meaning. But it's that meaning that matters, that willingness to turn toward experience. So if that's kind of our basic way of practicing, the safeguard around this kind of creating this self-image of, you know, I'm trying to pretend like I'm really kinder and denying my unkindness, for example, is this willingness to open to all aspects of ourselves. It's almost like my teacher used to talk about, like, you laying out all the parts of yourself, the parts that you love and you're proud of and you cherish, and the parts that you wish weren't really there. You know, the parts that you're ashamed of or embarrassed by. To be able to see them, to open to them with a quality of balance. It doesn't mean we act from the parts which are unskillful or harsh or unkind or rageful, but we see them. We don't deny them. We open to them. So that's what I mean by this quality, the safeguard of this willingness to really know ourselves in a full way. A complete way. You know, I think that's one of our jobs as human beings, is to learn to be fully ourselves, to fully who we are, not just what we present we think we should be, but actually have this much deeper integration. And people, you know, perhaps those, you know, listening who have done some very deep work around this, whether it's in Dharma practice or therapy or recovery or all the above, when you've really made and met your own demons, all those shadow parts, all those parts you've really had so much charge around, and then learn to open to them, to accept them, to love them, so they're not so unconscious, not so driven by. There's a level of integrity and just wholeness that comes through. There's a way that you really land in yourself, and people sense that around you. So that's what the Buddha is, I think, pointing toward. The sutta doesn't talk about therapy or doing deep recovery work, but I imagine he would, you know, if that was part of the conditions of the Sangha that he was teaching, that he was attending to. So we have to also see, how can I open to this experience of being human? know, how do I work with my rage? Because when you have these unresolved stuff, you know, whether it's old trauma or if it's childhood rage, it's like you have to learn to attend to that very skillfully. You know, and Dharma, you know, helps you be present, helps you see it more fully, but we often need other tools around that. Otherwise, we do have risk this spiritual bypassing. And if life's conditions change, when things aren't so pleasant for us or things aren't going the way we want, those deeper rages tend to pop up. And if we're really sincere practitioners, when those pop up and reveal themselves, we see that as a chance to practice, not as a threat for our self-image. And that's an important piece to keep in mind, is to notice. When you do get triggered, do you want to deny the fact that you're triggered, or do you want to use it as a chance to practice, to learn about yourself, to see what is unseen, to see where that ignorance is arising? So the way the Buddha presented this sutta, this, some of the beautiful images of this around metta, you know, I want to do this kind of caveat of, you know, doing our own work around it. And one way he suggested, which I think is a very powerful way, as long as we have this quality of really turning toward experience in all aspects of ourselves, is a metaphor of nature. And how nature holds a level of, we use this word emptiness a lot, but it's really this fullness. It's really the emptiness of identification, of personalization, and yet there's this way of deep, how should I say it? There's kind of a richness, a unity, a vastness, an aliveness of nature that completely meets whoever and whatever you are. I mean, next time you're really upset, go tell a tree about it. The tree's not gonna react to you, right? It's gonna completely meet you, how you are. It has this incredible capacity to feel the grief, to hold the grief, because it's not identifying with it. And I often use that when I'm feeling a lot of emotionality. I like to go out in nature and just let nature kind of just let it expand beyond this narrow container to this vaster container, and something softens in relationship to it. So the Buddha used this analogy. He says basically, you know, be like the earth. When you're feeling this insult, when you're feeling this pain, be like the vastness of the earth that is able to absorb and hold it. Be like the spaciousness and the emptiness of the air itself, that someone could try to paint it or try to color it, and it just does not stick at all. It just vanishes. You know, be like the vast river, the Ganges, that you have a torch trying to catch it on fire, and it just gets extinguished in that, the vastness of it. And in that space, express metta, not only to this other person, but then beyond to all beings, right? So it kind of keeps calling us back from this personal, because the more personal we take it, the more identified with it we are with it, the more pain we're going to feel, right? Sometimes we have to attend to that personal pain. We can't jump over the fact that we have it. And we have to learn to attend to it in a skillful way. And at some point, it is helpful to kind of expand beyond that personal pain, actually see the vastness of it. And so metta, offering metta in all the directions, emanating all forward. So in this sutta, he's connecting this interesting juxtaposition between metta, which we often think of it as these personal phrases. May you be safe and protected. May I be safe and protected. May I be peaceful. To this wordless quality, just emanating in this direction and that direction, touching all beings equally, without distinction, like the essence of nature. Now, this piece here, there's also a more subtle quality of spiritual bypassing that I just wanted to touch upon. And this goes back to when we have some personal pain and we really get a sense of this emptiness, this vastness, this sense of non-self and relationship. We can kind of call that forth. And in some ways, that personal pain tends to seem like it vanishes and falls away. So sometimes that's very, very helpful. That's actually very skillful and wise to do. And sometimes it's actually a form of spiritual bypassing. We're avoiding feeling it. And that goes back to that safeguard, that willingness to turn toward our experience, to turn toward all aspects of ourselves, to hear the feedback, the impact of our actions on other people, to really open in a full, clear way, in an honest way. You know, if we're able and willing to do that, yeah, then this emptiness way of teaching, this way of loosening this sense of self is actually very healing. It's very beneficial. And if we use it as a way to avoid that, to deny that, to kind of push things down, then it's not so helpful. It actually causes a lot of destruction, a lot of harm in our lives, depending on how much power we have, how much influence we have. So I really appreciate that the Buddha brought these two things together. This example, it's almost a comical example of this woman trying to pretend to be really kind and her servant, you know, not being so nice and then having that anger erupt with this vastness of nature, this emptiness of nature, that we have to hold both of those. You know, can we not deny anything of ourselves and yet still have this perspective of this vastness? And that becomes this really interesting juxtaposition of our practice and the way of being in the world. Because sometimes we feel like, okay, I want to be really loving and connected. Okay, I work with that and I get reactive and I get open my heart. And then sometimes we get into this place of emptiness and then we may become a little distant from life. There's a quote from Narsagada who said something like, "When I look inside, I see that I am nothing. When I look outside, I see that I am everything. In between, and that is love." Okay, so between these two, between this emptiness internal and the external love and interconnection, that's where my life flows. This is a beautiful way of holding that. That we can both fully meet the humanness in ourselves and others, and yet have this vaster perspective. And that's this is the interesting dance that we go in this path. And metta is an essential piece of this, essential part of how we practice. All right, let's just sit quietly for a couple of moments, letting those words settle. Okay, welcome back. So I thought tonight, it might be nice to do this form of discussion called a dialogue or a dyad, I should say. So two, dyad two. And the way this works is that you find one other person and basically they're going to be asking you a simple question, right? As you hear that question, you know, let that just kind of settle in and see what arises from that in response to that. So it's actually nice to not kind of think it too much, but actually just almost be surprised about what emerges from it. And if you do this, you know, really in a sincere way, it can actually bring you to a much deeper quality, almost like you've been, you know, in the middle. Sometimes when I've done it, I feel like I've been in a retreat for a few days because there's a level of stillness that arises from that. All right? So when I ring the bell, we'll go for 5 minutes asking the question, right now, how do you express metta? So we have a chance now if you want to share how that was like, any insights you have, or anything you like to ask around this vast topic of metta. So in the room, you can raise your physical hand and we'll bring a mic around. Online, you can raise your virtual hand or physical hand if you're patient enough and I can see it. All right, Stephen.
My partner shared with me a new thought, nature giving metta to itself.
Say that one more time, Stephen. Yes.
Nature giving metta to itself.
Nature giving metta to itself.
That we're part of nature.
Beautiful. All right. Anyone else like to ask or share anything?
It was really easy to go second because my partner shared with such sincerity and so many insights that I just wanted to bathe her in metta. Truly. And then it was interesting to think about, well, like the how of it. Mm-hmm. How is that happening? And not get lost in the, well, and just to notice like what would come up as I did it. Am I staying with being authentic? Am I trying to make someone feel better? All those little parts to it. So, yeah. Thank you.
Beautiful. Like we practice with something like metta. We see all the things that are kind of like metta, but not quite, or that, you know, all those interpersonal things we tended to do. And the metta, we can also start to realize there's metta is kind of something other than that, too. It's not that we don't take care of people, but we have those relational patterns, and yet metta is this other quality we start to notice. How can I allow that to come forth? And it is kind of tap into what Stephen was sharing, that metta nature is like kind of this nature is offering metta to itself. Let's see, I think I saw her hand next, okay. And then we can go over here.
Okay.
I think that's the sequence, but.
I just found the structure of the exercise pretty challenging because I'm used to, you know, the normal conversational give and take style where you know, Ben was saying really interesting things and I wanted to be like, oh, that's interesting. Like, tell me more about that. And I couldn't do it. And so that was a real exercise in mindfulness of, you know, following the directions, the way the exercise was structured. But yeah, I found that very, very challenging. So I don't know if that applies to anybody else, but. Yeah.
Yeah, the dyad's kind of a unique format when we do kind of suspend the normal conversational rules or ways we like to engage. And that's why we don't do it that often. We often do just more the give and take because it does allow that aliveness and that interaction. So yeah, you know, the challenge sometimes though that's helpful to, okay, what's it like to offer and receive in this way? But thanks for sharing that.
Thank you, Cheryl. Yeah, that's very similar to my comment that I was going to make, but that in that way, I felt like I was practicing metta as the listener.
Oh, nice.
And keep holding that space, right? And turning toward my partner. Yeah.
Yeah, so real time, you found it as an action of metta. Like, okay. You know, I want to say something, I want to add or ask more, follow up, okay, but instead the metta of actually listening. Yeah, beautiful. Beautiful. Anyone else like to ask or share anything? Anyone online like to do that? All right, Deb. Come on from Whidbey Island here. Let's see, maybe you don't have permission to unmute. How about now?
Ah, presto. Magic. The question of nature offering metta is interesting because I am in a physically different environment than I have been. And so to think about the cedar trees around our house here, standing like sentinels, you know, offering metta through their presence because mm-hmm. they have a very big, prominent physical presence that I do feel when I go outside and look at them and stand with them. And then there's the water nearby and the mountains and clouds that we can see so much of. The sky is just so much bigger here than it was in Seattle, you know, and so that really does come through. They come through as their own beings, their own sentient beings, mm-hmm. in a way that I frankly didn't experience them when I was in the city.
Mm. Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, there was kind of really nature focused or wild areas. They have that nature is so hard to ignore. Just if you listen, you listen so it's so easy to listen and hear that quality of presence. And you can also start to say, you know, here's a koan for you. It's what if your true nature is not different from that vastness of the ocean, from the sea, from the cedar trees? Practice with that. See if that's not true. All right, anyone else? Your last chance to talk about metta this year. Someone else want to raise their hand online? Okay, yeah, go ahead, Liv.
Hello?
Hello.
Hey. Yeah, I just wanted to share my experience. I found that the structure felt really supportive to being with my experience of being human in conversation, which is typically very anxious, especially with people that I don't know. And so taking off that layer of response, or almost like a handicap of my responses that I give to someone to cover up that anxiety and not be with that experience of anxiety. I found it allowed me to really soften and be quite tender and soft with someone I hadn't spoken to before, which I really, really appreciated.
Yeah, beautiful. I think that's ideally what it does, is that, yeah, there's a awkwardness, as a couple of people mentioned, I'm not used to interacting in this way. But if we can relax into the form, there's this freedom that I can actually allow, even with a complete stranger, a way of being really open and intimate with my own experience. You know, if they're really offering the metta of the listening, they're really listening deeply, and just kind of let that be an invitation to go and understand yourself in a deeper, fuller way. So thanks for sharing that, Liv.
Yeah, I really noticed with the first question how much my expression of metta was physical and in my body. And I'm noticing now that just taking the time to notice where that was, I feel a lot more open-hearted than when I came in here tonight. So I'm just thinking that could be an interesting question, at other times. So yeah, thanks.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, that asking questions, this came up in the day long on Saturday, just 2 days ago. Yeah, 2 days ago, just the art of meditative inquiry or meditative questions and something like that. How am I expressing metta? Can call us into this physical expression, which then calls us into a different relationship to this present moment. Whether we're, how does metta show up in this traffic jam? How does it show up with this annoying person? How does it show up with this little baby or whatever it might be? And yeah, noticing how it shows up as a body experience. Yeah, beautiful. And it does shift our way of being in the world in this moment. Thanks for sharing that. All right, Alan, go ahead.
All right. Can you hear me now?
Yep, we can.
Great. I really appreciated the question, because this isn't, a standard inquiry question. It's not something that I had an answer to. So I didn't go into it just knowing kind of what to say. And I at first was battling with making what I was saying authentic and really connecting to authenticity. But then there was it's just whoa, looking at having a having a conversation, it's a dyad. It's not about my authenticity. It's not about, and it was just like this, there was just like a kind of feeling of, the expansiveness or the bottom dropping out, because it's just like, this isn't about, this is, it's hard to say it isn't about me, but it's also broader than that. It's about, there's a mutual contact being made here. That was really, really special.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, that it's a powerful practice, because there's this interpersonal nature to it, and because it's interpersonal, there's all the things that we bring to that. I want to try to be authentic. I want to try to be sincere, and yet the practice itself can take us to that falls away. That any sense of it's like you become, it's this paradox, become in some ways less personal, less defined, and yet more connected to another person. And that's one of those really interesting paradoxes of practice. So thank you for sharing that, Alan. All right, Tricia.
I had the good fortune of not being with anybody to start off with. And so I kind of got to practice the loving kindness of just noticing what that was like, oh, something's different happening. And then I just was like, okay, I'm just going to go ahead. And it was great. And to see like the loving kindness, the difficulty and the sweetness, I guess, of just trying to listen to myself, like, how do I just be both of these, like the speaker and the listener? It was fantastic. And then had a great opportunity of being able to drop into a group that was already ongoing and experience the sort of loving kindness in my arrival. So I don't know, loving kindness amidst uncertainty was kind of a sweetness of my experience.
Great. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. I noticed that you were all by yourself and, but that's a great way of practicing with it. Is that, okay, this is the circumstances. Okay, I'm by myself. Maybe I can do the listener and the receiver. And then, oh, now I'm with two other people. Then this is it. But that you can start to see there's this fluidity that our practice starts to give us. Oh, this is the situation right now. I can still meet this. And loving kindness is such a beautiful way to lead with that. Lead with the heart. Lead with connection and curiosity. Right.
And now to be able to take that out into the rest of life. I appreciate my group members helping me with that. We'll keep going.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah. And that's part of the big integration of our practices. Because, how does it show up? Can it show up with, like, a good test is, can my practice show up with someone who's not a meditator? Can I still interact with them with as much attention and kindness? I don't have to, be using those phrases, may you be safe and protected, or but there's this way of interacting that people really appreciate. People, I think we long for that as human beings.
And then how can I show loving kindness towards myself when I forget to do it, when I'm not in, when I'm not on the cushion, or how does that continue there? But
yeah, exactly. That internal, external, sometimes we focus on the external, sometimes we focus on the internal, but that's such an essential piece, is can I start to meet all those little, mistakes, or those little, failures or forgetfulness, not as, okay, that reinforces that sense of me as the bad person or whatever our story might be, but more, oh, this is a chance for me to actually learn, to grow with.
Yeah,
beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. All right. Anyone else? We have time for maybe one more.
Hi, this is Anne. Just kind of thinking backwards through the process, we talked about nature as like dynamic, but also just stable. So it really had this kind of holding, like a sense of just holding while doing its own thing, but very, it felt so safe. And so then I kind of am now like really appreciating the structure of 5 minutes of speaking and just not doing all the normal things that we do to keep a conversation going, but also just holding the space. So it was like kind of mirrored in that and created this kind of safety. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, that's stability. That's a nice way of connecting, because nature does have that stability, that way of holding experience, and how, you know, as a listener, we can have that, like where I'm like the tree, like the cedar tree or the ocean, just holding this other person's experience. We do that externally, we do that internally, and it becomes this beautiful kind of ballast, this container that, you know, things we start to trust, that's able to hold this painful life that we have, these painful circumstances. So that something can arise and be painful, and yet there's something that's also aware of our feet touching. It's also aware of the beauty of nature. And that's part of that vastness of nature. Yeah, thank you, Anne. All right, so we've come to our closing time. So I just want to thank all those who participate in the dyads.